Unlike many of the other talks here, I didn't have my slides in advance. I was sort of thinking about what I was going to say in real time during the meeting. And so it'll get a little ragged. Don't worry about it. You might think that you know, I should be very nervous and flustered right now. But one thing about having done this twice a week, starting over 35 years ago, is that you develop nerves of steel. So what I'm going to talk about, I'm trying to, I'll preface it slightly. I'll say I have a joint appointment at Cornell where I'm jointly between the physics and the information science department. So many of these developments, including ImageNet and attention mechanisms, I've been seeing developing in real time because I go to all of the CS computer science job talks. And so it's the best way to see what the cutting edge research areas are. And they have two job talk colloquiums a week from January through late May. It's an extraordinarily rigorous, they make, you know, 10 to 15 offers and then lose most of them to industry. So what I'm going to, in order to preface my talk, let me show you a slide which is useful to be aware of. This is archived data, just articles with machine learning or deep learning in the title or abstract going back to 2010. And so what you see here, of course, is it's in the noise, and then starting, you know, in this ImageNet era, I'll say something more about that in a moment. Well, just to say, you know, where we are in this current realm is in 2012. People have mentioned this before, Hinton and his collaborators. ImageNet is a competition started in 2009. These competitions are great drivers of progress and algorithms, about 20 million images, 20,000 categories, and you have to classify the content of the image. And ordinarily, in this sort of machine learning computer vision, the improvements from year to year are measured in a few percentage points. People would show these slides of the improvements over the past decade. And then suddenly something stunning happened in 2012. Hinton and his collaborators, you know, were 41% better than any of the competitors that year. And, you know, in a strong sense, that was the explosion of interests. There was one other anecdote that I was told at the time was in the preceding decade, there was this AI winter, and the people working on neural networks said, bemoaned the fact that they couldn't get a paper on neural networks into their own conference, Neural Information and Processing Systems. And so, around the 2007 timeframe, they decided they needed to rebrand, and their Hinton, Lacan, and Yoshua Bengio got together at a restaurant in Montreal and decided we need to get a new name, and they came up with deep learning. And it was, how could you come out against it? You'd have to favor something like shallow forgetting. And but, you know, it wasn't just the rebranding, of course. It was in large part the GPUs that Hinton had the foresight to use his Canadian research funding to buy lots of these things. And they were perfectly positioned for doing these matrix calculations that enabled both the architectures of these deep learning networks and also permitted experiment. Instead of taking a few months to train, you could take a few hours to train the same thing, and you could play with, should you use a sigmoidal activation, should you use a rectified linear unit, and they could come up with the right heuristics. Because ultimately, of course, this whole field is still a collection, amazing heuristics, but we don't have a deep theory behind it. So you can see, and then the green here is, you know, the subset that are in physics. And so it's not obvious, but it's It's growing at the same percentage rate, the infiltration of these ideas into physics. Now, by remarkable coincidence, the same data is also Cornell undergraduate majors in computer science and information science, and we see same data. We project that within 5 years, every Cornell undergraduate will be a computer science major, and it's not restricted to just Cornell. More to the point, here is just something amazing. This is just to give the context why a conference like this is so timely. If we look at the number of articles in our standard subject areas, these are the physics areas down here, you can see in the legend. And these are increasing. They're just not increasing as quickly. I mean, from the last 2.5 years, probably a 10% increase in the number of submissions. Whereas you look at these two top categories, they come from actually out of nowhere 4 or 5 years ago. And CS Learning basically doubled in a single year. It was already one of the biggest, and nonetheless it doubled, and it hit this over 1,000. And just as a historical artifact, when I constructed the original accessor numbers in 1991, I used 3 digits because I said no category could possibly have more than 1,000 submissions. I mean, no field is even remotely that large. Actually, that up to 1,000 seem like too generous, since the original design was for 10 papers a month. But in these periodicities, these peaks, of course, are these ridiculous conference deadlines they have in these fields. Okay, so I wanted to go back 2 days ago, just to give a slight context for what I'll be trying to explain here. And I'm going to try to go slowly and pedagogically. Some of the talks have been impressively loaded with information. I'm very happy to be following Isaac, who gave a remarkably pedagogic talk, even to the extent of permitting us to count 9 dots in a 3x3 grid. And I'm going to try to go slowly. I can stop at any time. And also, please feel free to just throw questions out. I'll repeat them. We'll see what happens. So this is one of the slides that Juan showed. I've annotated it. It was a text generation from a language model. I'll try to explain what a language model is. I've annotated it because I recognized where it came from. The language model this was using was, as he said, a transformer language model. It was what I identified as fake news. Somebody discovered a herd of unicorns living in a remote, previously unexplored valley, and it goes on to write remarkably good text explaining it. It's a model that came out of OpenAI, one of these Silicon Valley startups, and it was called GPT-2 for generative pre-training transformer. Another slide that he used was using this data from this article he referred to, and I've added the link to it, that just makes the statement. This was 2018, so within a year it had become the state of the art in machine translation, relying on attention-based mechanisms. And so Juan's talk was about the actual associated physics, and I'm going to step backwards and just, given the importance of this computing paradigm and architecture, just try to slowly go through how these things work. So in order to do this, I'm going to think about how I would teach this if I were teaching an undergraduate class. And I'll even use some slides on language models for that in a moment. Here's the article itself, mid-2017. And again, I'll abuse my privilege of having inside data on these things to show you something that's absolutely, I'll show you in a moment something that's absolutely, let me go since I started the wrong sentence. I'll show you something that's absolutely astounding to me, having, you know, seen these things over the course of many years. This is the download data for this article. So notice in roughly 2 years, it's had on the order of 1 million views. And these 1 million views are not the general public. I mean, you know, sometimes you'll get something referred to in Science or the New York Times, it'll bring in lots of non-researchers. We don't have any evidence for that. We actually know, you know, how these people are being referred. I have that, that's the color scheme in the legend. And what you can see here is, you know, the first week it showed up, already had, you know, 40,000 people looking at it. Well, or one person through a distributed proxy looking at it 40,000 times. But, and you can see, you know, something, the orange here is a lot of this communication is mediated via Twitter. And then each one of these additional events, you know, the brown over here, Google Research posted some blog post about it, gets a spike, gets a spike, gets a spike. But, you know, the remarkable thing is it's growing. But, you know, it's growing from the currently this week. It's getting, like, you know, 15,000 views. I don't want to disparage anyone here or including myself, but, you know, most of us would be completely thrilled to write an article that got a few thousand views over its lifetime. And this is getting 15,000 per week currently. So it's had an extraordinary amount of impact, as Juan mentioned, already over 2,000 citations. And just to compare, I've picked a random article, something about machine learning phases of matter. You know, somewhat similar, but the scale on this graph, it's different by a factor of 20. And, you know, this is, you know, this is already great. This is, you know, in 3 years on the order of 25,000 views. And, you know, in Hollywood parlance, this is something that has tails. You know, the typical paper might have a giant spike and then an exponential fall off. And these things that tend to, you know, remain accessed over long periods of time are more often review articles or the impactful articles. Let me get back to the order I was planning. Here are the results. They trained this model 12 hours on 8 GPUs. On German, English to German translation, French to English-French, and English-German translation. Each one had many millions of sentences, and they beat, you know, in all of these things, there's some metric. The metric for translation is something called BLEU, B-L-E-U score. It stands for Bilingual Evaluation Understudy. It's actually a very primitive, surprisingly, primitive metric. You look at the target sentence and you have some measure of how many of the words in your translation appear in some target sentence. And that target sentence, of course, is not necessarily, you know, invariant or the best, but, you know, it's the best metric they have. And there are a bunch of, you know, you have to be careful about things because it's possible for it would be possible for these translation things to cheat. For example, if, you know, you just said every sentence was a sequence of eight thes, then all of the words you had actually appeared in the target text, but you don't want to give a perfect score for that. The usual thing, as you've seen, as you would have seen, that suddenly in 2017 you had a new model that was outperforming everything that preceded it. What preceded it was typically these RNN, recursive neural network models, and I'll explain why they're used in sequence modeling. Okay, so my first elementary comment is going to be just to explain what is a language model. So explain what a language model is. I'm going to do a real-time, I'm going to risk doing a real-time demo to train a language model for you. This is, It looks like a 6-year-old Mac Air, but it's actually the first commercial version of this exascale Aurora computer from Argonne that I'm going to run it on here. And my language model is going to be what's known as a trigram language model. It goes back even further, but there was a Usenet newsgroup user in the 1980s by the name of Mark V. Chaney, which was, of course, a play on Markov chain. And this is the code that I wrote in order to demonstrate this. And what we do is we just iterate through some training data set, the simplest imaginable model, and you start by initializing your bigram, that's a two-word combination, as the first two words, and then you iterate through the text, and as you iterate through the text, every time you have a trigram dictionary, and every time a word appears after a bigram, you've seen, you just append it to the end of the list. And so in the end, you return this dictionary that you've trained on, and it has things like this. You would have a bigram based on, and then I've applied a counter to the list, and so in the training set that I actually used, the word the appeared 26 times, and here are all of the words that appeared after based on. Here are all the words, you know, ordered by occurrence based on that followed on A. And then, you know, since I've made a big long list of them, including their multiplicities, for my language, for my generative model, I can just take a little window and then pick at random among those words, since they're counted with multiplicity that will, you know, respect the empirical probability distribution that I've seen. And so here's my, I do this because it's all incredibly simple code. We just iterate through it. We have a current pair. We do a random choice on the list associated to that current pair, append that, update our current pair by shifting the window one, and then just iterate through this with some stop point. And so the picture is we have this pair. Maybe we come up with spring. We move the window. We keep going, and we keep going. And we end up generating something like that. So here's where I take my gigantic risk. Something else. To show you I've got nothing up my sleeve, I will restart my kernel. Okay. Kernel ready. See if this works. So I import my stuff. This is a program I showed you already. I run this one. And here is, on my ultra-fast supercomputer, you see it trained instantly. What am I training it on? Let's just see if I can see what, if I have my data here. Okay. I probably need to,
but it doesn't really matter.
You can see this is just, it's a bunch of abstracts. From articles, thousands of them, and in order to make it coherent in subject area and commensurate with this, I did this yesterday at lunchtime, I just pulled out abstracts that had either machine learning or deep learning, and they had the word quantum.
So, you know, machine learning on quantum design, that seemed commensurate. And then let's just see, confirm that this thing worked. So here are the top bigrams of the machine learning are the ones that occur the most. This just confirms, these examples that I gave. And let's just generate with it. So first I gotta in particular, whether a TNS can be used to assist deep learning, we introduce a quantum processor, which is at most 7 qubits, possess computational capabilities. This is also a bit of a run-on. We highlight the best-known classical complexity theory. Our result opens a new class of classical quantum channels with memory, which satisfy a so-called channel factorization property, et cetera. I generated a bunch of these. And basically, I got a little unlucky, but basically they're all good. We use HIPNN, a neural network proposed to help optimize underlying objective function. This work can readily be extended to the number and type of the differential geometry and the logarithmic negativity. High performance in a common principled framework. So the key to this is, that makes it funny, but makes it a Markov model we usually describe as memoryless, is that every three-word combination, appeared somewhere in the training set. It's just that by the time you get to the end of the sentence, you no longer have any coherence with what you started on in the sentence. And, there are plenty of technical things. This implies BQQ poly is contained in the bipartite graph, efficiently implemented on commercially available quantum annealing machines produced by quantum measurement. So, this is a remarkably primitive language model, but, insofar as many of these things are indistinguishable from actual abstracts, this is a reflection on the language model being used by the people who produce these things. Yes? I'd have to look. It was on the order of 2,000 abstracts. You're probably worried that, if the training set is really sparse, then you guys can come in. If it's really sparse, it'll just memorize. There will only be one completion of every two-word thing, and it'll just do that. But that's clearly not what's happening here. Okay. So, there's, it keeps recurring, about 4 years ago, I think there was a, some website, what would you say, which did exactly the same thing. You would feed in some text and it would complete it. So we want to do something more sophisticated than this. As I said, you lose the coherence at the beginning of the sentence. You want a more sophisticated language model. So the first thing that people tried, I came back. Move it to the next slide. Okay. So what's a recursive neural network as a language model? And this is effectively a very simple notion. That's why people in talks usually don't bother describing it. But the picture is we have some input sequence of tokens. These tokens could either be character level or word level. And so I sub t is the input at time step t. And we input this into our network. At the same time, we get some measure of context. We get some hidden state that was the output of the t minus first step. And so we combine our new token with whatever we remembered. In the case of that trigram language model, the only thing we knew was the current two words. But you can imagine somehow retaining some knowledge of the entire, this is autoregressive in the sense that it uses, in principle, everything up to what you've seen. And then you output a new hidden state based on your update of the hidden state and the input token, you input a new one, and then this continues. Now, the difficulty with this is, first, what's the problem this is trying to solve? This is an example given from the Google blog entry about the transformer of something that's known as, co-reference resolution. So here's an English sentence. The animal didn't cross the street because it was too tired. L'animal n'a pas traversé la rue parce qu'il était trop fatigué. I guess in French-Canadian, l'animal n'a pas traversé la rue parce qu'il était trop fatigué. And the difficulty you have here is that you need to know in French, because it's gendered, is this it, you know, what does the it refer to? Because there's a similar sentence which just ends with a single word that's different, that it was too wide. And, you know, if because we can parse the language, we know if it says too wide, we're using this huge amount of common sense to realize the it here has to refer to the street. The street is feminine, la rue, and, you know, then you have to say qu'elle était trop large. And the difficulty for a recurrent neural network is to figure out both that the it here, whether the it refers to the animal, whether the it refers to the street. And in particular, it has a lot of difficulty because up to this point, if it only sees the things that preceded it, it doesn't even know what's coming, whether it was tired or wide. So it's hard to output the right sequence here if you can't anticipate ahead. So these are some of the problems that are solved by this transformer model that I'm about to describe. You know, the other issue is because you're passing these things one step at a time, in practice, in an architecture, the way it works is you've just got, you know, the recursion is you've got some block and then you have an edge that comes back and feeds back into your input. And so works just like a recursive program. And you just lose that information. By the time you get to a sentence, you have to very delicately tune these things so that you're, you know, passing the context one word at a time, and you still have the information you need by the time you get to the word that you are trying to model. So it's difficult to model long-range dependencies. The other difficulty is it's hard to make it computationally efficient because it's difficult to parallelize. You're reading it in one sequence at a time, and so you're stuck doing one thing at a time. Now, the transformer architecture, and I always find these pictures of architectures sort of forbidding, so I'm going to try to unwrap this thing. But just to give you the top-level overview, here are the inputs. It gets passed through something. This is the so-called encoder. I'll describe what this is the basic tension mechanism over here, and it gets us to put through one final fully connected feed-forward layer. And this thing can be just replicated in their actual model. They did this with n equals 6, so they had 6 copies of this thing moving forward. And then there's a, this vertical column is the decoder. And the decoder just, starts with what the encoder produces is you take some text and it transforms it into some encoded version, we could consider some universal encoded version, and then your decoders can then decode that abstract representation of the text into any language, depending on what they've been trained on. And the decoders, you know, start, you just plug it in word by word. And one of the key features here is that the decoder in the middle has access to this abstract encoding that you've produced by the encoder for use at all times. So I'll say how that works in a moment. And, you know, we're going to use this attention here to model long-range dependencies. So how do we do this? And this is the one absolute key slide that I tried to write last night. And this slide is dense, but I wanted to get everything on one single slide, you know, to just illustrate how straightforward it is. And I didn't want to, bring up text one at a time because I always find that sort of distracting. And moreover, as a you know, a meta comment on attention, when I'm sitting in the audience, I look at all parts of the slide and I see how these parts inform the early, how the early applies to the late. And so it gave me some meta representation of what I'm trying to explain here. The way attention works is we think about it in information retrieval language. We have three vectors. These are so-called vector embeddings. Words are represented in some higher dimensional space. The number of dimensions will be 512 in practice. And each word has three features associated to it, three sets of features associated to it, what's known as a query, and then a set of key value pairs. So I and J here just run over all of the words in the sentence. We're going to train all of these things. And you know, the query you can think of as the word sending to all of the other words in the sentence that we're looking at and just asking each word how much attention should I pay to you. And the key of all of these other words, all of these embeddings are learned in the course of training the model. The key tells you, okay, you've got that query, here's how much attention you should be spending, and the way you determine that is governed just by a simple dot product. So you've got a query, you've got a vector, each one of those 512 dimensions has some semantic content. When they align, then it tells you how much to weight the value, and your output of the attention is going to be the value of that mechanism. So specifically, you start at word I, you look at all of the other words in the sentence you're looking at, you calculate these dot products, you normalize them by the dk here is just the size of your key values. As I said, could be 512, it'll turn out to be smaller than that for a reason I mentioned in a moment. They do this normalization because we're throwing it through a softmax, just for reference. What's a softmax? It's this simple function. You know, it looks like sort of a Boltzmann distribution where the denominator is a partition function. We take each of these real values, we exponentiate it, we normalize it to the sum. So this is a probability distribution over this index I. And you know, it becomes very strongly peaked. If these are high in dimension, then your softmax is basically becomes a one hot. So you want to avoid that and get some more regular probability distribution if you like a smaller gradient so it's possible to train. And then this is the entire thing. This is the attention you're going to pay. If your word I, the vector representation you're going to build, the updated vector representation is you query the keys of all of the other words. Incidentally, if you're looking at something that's a window of size n, clearly this is an order n squared algorithm. And you know, people have tried to, there are newer proposals that are order, you know, n root n or n log n, and it depends on the text. But for you know, the smaller sentence size, you're not really paying a big price for that n squared. You calculate this probability distribution or you know, set of normalized weights, and then you just weight the values associated with the keys of the world, of all of the words, including the word you're looking at, and that gives you an updated value, and that's the new vector representation. So that's the entire thing. The way this is realized in practice is you take advantage of your GPUs, do matrix multiplication on everything, you have your queries, and you just take the query vectors for all of the words and stack them up so they make a matrix. The keys, you do the same thing, and then you know this thing just becomes a matrix multiplication of value. You do them all simultaneously, and that's the key to the parallelizability, which is you know in the recursive network you can only do one thing at a time, but here you can efficiently update the how much attention each word pays to all of the other words in your sequence by doing in matrix multiplication adapted to your GPUs. Now, the one additional, the reason I said that, you know, it wasn't actually 512, that was the full size of the vector, which is they use something known as multi-headed attention, because there are different notions of attention. A word might want to pay attention to a different word to a word in the beginning of the sentence for one reason, it might want to pay attention to a word at the end of the sentence for another reason. So you effectively hedge your bets. Instead of using the full 512 dimensional representation space, you duplicate this attention mechanism by a factor of 8. And so you train 64 dimensional vectors in this case, and each one of these is trained independently. So you have the possibility of learning 8 independent things, independent, you know, properties of words, independent semantic content, you know, whatever hierarchical representation you're going to learn. And then how do you combine these together? Well, you just take these 8 separate things and concatenate them. So you had these 8 64-dimensional vectors. Concatenation means, you know, in language, in linear algebra terms, direct sum of the vector spaces and tack them together. So here's the final representation of these models. Your ordinary attention was the softmax. You have these I heads, these matrices, W, Q, K, and V are, in this case, just 512 by 64 matrices, and they're projection matrices. Again, everything is something you learn. So the model, in the course of training, in order to either best represent the you know, predict the next word in a sequence of language, or to be able to be optimized for some translation task, learns these 8 separate projections onto the 8 separate spaces in the way to, you know, be best optimized for the task. And then the multi-headed attention is you take these, you know, separate 64-dimensional things, stick them together into one big vector, and then at the final stage you do a fully connected 512 by 512 transformation that mixes them up all together and gives you this optimal representation. And then, as I mentioned, all of these are parameters you can choose. They just used 8 heads, 512 dimensional model, so 64 dimensional vectors, and those were the dimensions of their keys and their values.
Sorry,
yeah. So W here are projection matrices. And so we've got these 512 dimensional word, you know, each word is represented by a 512 dimensional vector of real values. And we want to learn different aspects of these words. And so what we're going to do is we're going to run 8 of these attention mechanisms in parallel. And we don't know what to run it on. We're not going to run it just on separate our 512 thing naively into, you know, the first 64 bits, the next 64 in groups of 8. Since this is a machine learning exercise, we're going to learn the best subspaces to project on. And so this W here is a 512 by 60. There are 8 of these 512 by 64 dimensional matrices that are 8 separate projections that figure out 8 independent subspaces to be best adapted to the task at hand. And so that's a good question. All of these 3 W's are all 512 by 64 projection matrices, and there are 8 of them that find these, you know, incredibly adeptly chosen subspaces to optimize on. Okay, so there's one thing missing that I need to recall just for completeness, which is, as we know, position matters in life. And so I give the example of man bites dog. This is obviously very different from dog bites man.
How it, nothing I've said encodes that feature. And the way this is put in was actually on the original diagram. We have a positional encoding. We use just these simple sinusoids. So the their motivation for that was that by plugging in the positional information in terms of these straightforward wave vectors, then it would learn to pay its attention by relative position rather than absolute position, because you don't really care about absolute position. And this positional encoding was just put in right at the input. This was this other feature here that I didn't mention, whereas you just add this thing to the vectors, and so it also retains some notion of what order it came from. And oh, this is late night when I'm preparing slides, that's what I felt like. Okay, so what's the result of this? Is this true? Okay. Okay, I did what I said I wanted to do, which is I tried to give a slow, careful presentation. I have an entire second half of this talk, which is the really good part. as I told, I think I told Juan beforehand when I was worried about the state of my slides that it's my experience, I always worry about the stuff that'll come an hour after what I had time for, and that was true in this case as well. So let me, just try to, I'll reorganize what I was going to do. So here were the examples I gave before, this coreference resolution, and you can actually see there are lots of visualizations of these things that I'll change mode and go through fairly quickly, but the stronger color here is just representing the attention one thing pays for another, and so you see in the sentence that ends with tired, it's learned to pay attention. It pay attention to animal in its abstract representation. So when it translates to French, it knows to use the masculine gender. And the same when it says wide, it's learned in the course of this training procedure to pay more attention to street. So it knows to come up with female. Here are just, you can look at lots and lots of patterns for what the attention of various, and so I was prepared to describe some of these, but let me just summarize this slide as explainable AI is overrated. The machines are going to be better at all of this than us, so just deal with it. Here's, the kind of, again, I was going to say more about this, but I've got the link, so I'll put up the slides. And so lots of visualizations of what this thing is doing. One point I do want to make about this is the point I made 2 days ago, which is how natural it is if you're trying to learn a probability distribution over quantum states. There's nothing when you're reading in a quantum state, some set of qubits that's entangled. There's no notion of this autoregression. I mean, you're not learning anything by considering them in a sequence, typically. And so it's completely natural to use this kind of attention mechanism to learn the probability distribution because you're simultaneously looking at measurement values, whether they came from a POVM or whatever, to see how every different measurement in every different basis affects the one you're looking at in order to reconstruct that probability distribution. I should say a little something about this. This is an animation that came from the Google blog, which is just saying, showing you what happens when you do the translation. First, you encode. Each word starts out being informed just by the previous layer, and then it gets information from all layers, and then the decoding has access at all stages to the final representation from the encoding layer. That's what makes it so powerful. there's a mask on the attention so that the decoding only sees what was previous, but it has the information from the entire sequence in the encoding layer. And so that's why it becomes so good at this. And moving quickly, since 2018, there's been all sorts of progress, and as was mentioned in the, Isaac mentioned that things are moving quickly when there's a profusion of acronyms, and you know, you've got BERT, which is bidirectional encoding. If there's BERT, there has to be an ELMO, embeddings from a language model. This G. What? Ernie is here somewhere. They didn't get a Miss Piggy yet. This GPT-2 from the slides that Juan used was early 2019, I'll say something. And Google has, from the OpenAI, Google has Transformer XL, the extra large version. It learns dependencies 80% longer than RNNs, 450% longer than vanilla transformers. And these things are all, you know, examples of transfer learning. Important to emphasize, it was originally for language models, for translation, but once it's learned, it turns out it has all of the semantic content. You can use it for speech recognition. You can use it for semantic parsing, reading comprehension, performs well in these language models. I have a slide about that in a moment. So this is the source of that slide that Juan used early on, and I've highlighted a couple of things which are amusing. This was February of this year. Due to our concerns about malicious applications of the technology, we are not reducing the trained model. So this was a very intriguing statement for them to make. It was actually fairly controversial. Is this just a big publicity ploy on the part of OpenAI? How can we trust it? But then on the other hand, you know, seeing the quality of the text this produced, it's a little frightening. Just to anticipate where I would have gone, I do have, I don't know whether I should call it sophisticated, but people frequently ask me, how does Archive screen for junk? Why is it that you don't see refutations of special relativity, proofs of P equals NP, proofs of Fermat's last theorem, the Riemann hypothesis, and all the rest. And you know, the reason is we have moderators, but I learned a decade ago that that didn't scale to the daily volume. Humans just don't scale. They tend to get sick, take vacations, and get distracted, whereas a machine just reads everything. So I was able to train a model, I can say more about this in the Q&A period, that's actually remarkably effective in identifying the science from the non-science, let's call it generously. And these things terrify me because I've also trained a transformer model in archive text. And even if I could be successful on detecting its output, then we all know all I need to do is train some generative adversarial network, and I can make my generative model arbitrarily good. And why would anybody be submitting nonsense text-generated stuff to archive? The answer is quantum mechanics. Anything that can happen will happen, and believe me, it does happen. Okay. This was just for Roger, so I have to include it. He had a colloquium that I listened to as I was driving here on Sunday, where he talked about generating poetry. And people have used the same GP2 model to generate poetry. I use an example from there, a favorite, actually as much a sonnet as anything else, Percy Shelley's Ozymandias, with the traveler from an antique land who sees this wreck statue. And at the base of the statue, it says, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." This is, I guess, controversial now because the US president claims credit for having said this first. And Nothing beside remains around the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sand stretched far away. So they just plug this in as the first step in this, you know, generative procedure. And, you know, in case you wanted to know what came next, now you have it. The ebbing tide bears only the sands and trees that wave their boughs to the western breeze. And you can train it on your favorite poet. You can generate Walt Whitman. Maybe there are some Canadian poets that you prefer. And it gets the rhyming scheme right. It gets the meter right. It gets everything right. It's terrifying. Given I tried to emphasize Grim Reaper is standing, I tried to emphasize, you know, how simple the model was. It was like every deep learning thing, you get some architecture. As I said, you can emulate any function with a single layer that's sufficiently wide, but you just can't train the stupid thing. And then this is just something that's perfectly adapted to training on the hierarchical information that's contained in sentences. And, you know, there's an open question there as to whether I believe the answer will be absolutely yes, whether the same sort of hierarchical information contained in many-body quantum entanglement can be just as effectively learned, you know, for larger systems than has currently worked for recursive neural networks in this case. But just to tell you the kind of things they're saying, you know, recurrent neural networks are so 2014, we're young and experienced, drop them, they're no good, and all the companies, which is true, they've all moved over, you know, instantly to these transformer models. People describe it as that's why I intimated this ImageNet thing, at, you know, 2017 being sort of the ImageNet moment for natural language processing, where everything will shift to this new methodology. And as well, in ImageNet, one of the other amazing things was the, as I say, the transfer learning. If you have some new task, you use the trained ImageNet from like VGGNet or something like that, and you start with something that already knows how to detect edges and do various things, and you're, you know, immediately up and running. And so that's the direction that this is now going. And this is an example of this where this will be my final slide. Where in the past few years, and these are some of these, we have Big Bird here, but not Ernie, just in the past couple of years, we've more than halved the distance between the best model and human performance. And so again, we extrapolate and we expect superhuman performance on these things, just like, you know, Go and chess and all the rest, within a few years. The metric here is the so-called glue score, which involves question answering, a variety of other coreference resolution, a variety of natural language tasks, general language understanding evaluation. Okay, so I'll stop there. I'll put up for you to marvel at and maybe even poke at it if anybody asks me during the question period. Thank you, and sorry to run over.
There's a mic behind you. And yeah. I'll ask the next speaker to maybe come.
My question is, what is that?
Okay, so thank you for asking me that question. It's an absolutely fantastic question. I wanted to give an example of an embedding model. And so this is an embedding of the archive language model based on 2013 technology, which was a single layer. It's something called Word to VEC. And what we did was we made, and I just wanted to show you how powerful these were. This was a 200-dimensional word embedding, and I've dimensionally reduced it down to two dimensions using T-SNE. That's a, you know, standard T-distributed stochastic neighbor embedding that preserves the local neighborhood structure without worrying about the global structure. So each word, so each dot there is a word, and they're color-coded according to subject area. So you can see the extraordinary structure that's preserved by these word embeddings where, you know, over here we have high energy physics, supersymmetry, and all of the rest. I can zoom in, look for a black hole. Whoops. So black hole is sitting there, and then, you know, you can see absolutely all the words, you know, in the context of black hole, and you can see this was, you know, a language model that was trained to predict the next word in the sequence, and this is, you know, underlies the machine learning methodology that I mentioned that does both the categorization and knows how to spit out stuff that's produced by people who haven't learned to emulate the probability distribution, not only of the technical words, but the stylistic content, and, you know, can identify the science from the non-science. And, you know, you learn a bunch of fun things here. Suppose we look at this island of Japan, you know, and you discover it actually is the island of Japan. So the, you know, what's happening here is this is the extent to which Japanese authors tend to co-author, you know, with one another more than with other nationalities. And you see the same thing. There's a, you know, something of every nationality everywhere in here. Or you could look at, you know, it also understands the content versus the non-content words. So, you know, this. Area which I chose because it's sort of not concentrated in color is all the stylistic stuff, the hedge words, and everything else. And so, you know, this is the two-dimensional representation, but the full-dimensional representation, you know, the full 300 dimensions has all of this stuff. These were things that were used in the analogy task that the directions in this embedding space actually. Permit you to use a vector addition to solve analogies, and I had some examples of that too. But other questions?
I think we'll actually leave it there and postpone the other questions, and we'll. But let's thank Paul again.